Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Jane Bloom. On this program, we talk to people at the University of New Mexico who are doing very interesting things. Today is no exception. Our guest is Dr. Elena Bastea. She is an associate professor in the architecture department at the University of New Mexico. Welcome.
I'm very glad to be here.
Thank you. Well, we're very glad to have you. And I think even from those few words, I think people will know that you're not originally from here.
Well, a lot of people are not from here either. I originally come from Thessaloniki, Greece, which is where I was born and grew up. And then I came to this country to do my university work. And years later, I'm very happy to be in New Mexico. We came here 3.5 years ago.
And what attracted you to coming to study in the United States?
I went through a very strict, academically challenging high school program in Greece, and I knew I was interested in architecture, but the university studies in architecture in Greece are very technical from year one. So I was interested in the option of coming to the U.S. and attaining an undergraduate degree in the humanities before I move on to architecture at the graduate level. So that's what I did. I was fortunate to have a scholarship to attend Bryn Mawr College outside Philadelphia, where I studied art history. Then I went to Berkeley and did a master's in architecture and design. I was very attracted to the academic component, and I decided to stay and pursue a PhD in history of architecture. And after completing that, I started teaching history of architecture full-time. So yes. I've been teaching since 89.
Yes. And your humanities background is reflected in your research interests, I think, because you're interested in what is phrased as architecture and memory. Now, could you tell us what that really means?
I think actually when I started studying architecture at the graduate level, I was in history of architecture at the PhD level. I would have phrased it as, I'm interested in what buildings tell us about the people who built them and the meanings of those buildings for the people using them. But after teaching for a while, I realized that what students bring into the classroom is not necessarily what they get out of the architecture books or the famous architects, but really their own personal background of the types of spaces that were familiar to them when they were growing up. And sometimes they have the guts to be open about that heritage, let's say, discuss it in the classroom. Other times they tend to suppress it and pick up whatever is the current style in architecture. But slowly I came to see that we really do design through what we know best, through personal experience, either because we grew up in a certain environment or because we visited new places and inspired us and stayed in our memories. And so I'm closer, I think, to understanding the role of memory in both making architecture and understanding architecture. And that's why my second book, called Memory in Architecture, addressed these layers of how the built environment, as I say, marks us for life.
Yes, and as we will see, it not only marks us for life, but it's a reflection of our ideals sometimes. It's a reflection of what we would like things to be.
I think that's very much the case because on a simplistic level, people think you can study the level of a society, let's say its economy, philosophy, politics and so on by looking at the architecture. But as a historian of architecture, I would say that it is not a one-to-one direct relationship because buildings are about the dreams of a society. So you can have a wonderful new structure in a place that maybe is not doing so wonderfully economically speaking, but they want to project their dreams through the built form that will surpass them, that will survive them, that will be the legacy to the next generation. And oftentimes, historians might say that the height of architecture maybe marks the fall of an empire, that it's kind of the swan song.
Interesting.
So that would be one way to separate what we learn from again, the economic, political structure of a society and what we learn from its built form, which is more about dreaming about the future.
This is also reflected in one of the chapters of your book, Memory and Architecture. They were talking about the rebuilding of Dresden, Germany. And perhaps you would comment about that a little bit, because this city was firebombed by our forces in World War II.
Mm-hmm. I should make clear that the book Memory and Architecture is an anthology with essays
which
from
you edited.
Many colleagues coming both from architecture and comparative literature, art history, and so on. And I think the chapter on Dresden is, to me, memorable because Mark Jarzombek, the author of that essay, is questioning the correctness, so to speak, of or the appropriateness of rebuilding the synagogue that was destroyed in Dresden.
Yes.
And his point is, well, originally that synagogue was the home of a very vibrant community, Jewish community, in a vibrant city.
Right.
It was down by the river.
It was down by the river.
Exactly. And right now, most of the new Jewish residents have come from the former Soviet Union, from a very secular background. They're not familiar with the rituals that were there before. And so he is questioning this feel-good almost attitude of, oh, if we rebuild that synagogue, then there's a certain absolution, perhaps, of the destruction, which is not going to happen.
Well, I think he was very concerned about the architecture of that building, which he didn't think reflected Judaism at all.
Right.
And he was concerned about where this was located in proximity to or not far from certain reminiscences of the Nazi period and the socialist period.
Yeah.
I think that he was concerned about that as well.
And also is making the comparison between the Catholic Church that is rebuilt and the synagogue and the different architectural styles that were picked as being more appropriate for each one.
Right. I remember it was called the Frauenkirche, and they really tried to rebuild it the way it used to be.
In the Baroque times.
Right. But they didn't do it with the synagogue.
Exactly. And he's questioning that, and I don't think we have any answers. I think it's a good essay because it kind of pulls the rug from under our feet, even when we're thinking we're doing something that, let's say, mends these memories of catastrophe. Maybe we're just teasing ourselves. Maybe there is no way, no gesture to mend that past. Or maybe it should have been a different building.
So in case you're interested in that essay about Dresden and others, it's in the book that Eleni Bastea edited called Memory and Architecture, and it's published by University of New Mexico Press. Well, you also have some experience, or at least in your family, with this memory issue because, as I understand it, your maternal and paternal grandparents emigrated from Turkey to Greece. And could you talk about that? They were ethnically Greek, but they were in Turkey.
Right. And,
how did that happen?
And that leads a lot of people to say, so you're Turkish. And I don't think they would ever have said, we're Turkish. What happened was, if we don't think of Turkey as the Republic of Turkey, that was a secular republic established in 1923 by Kemal Atatürk, and we go back to the previous, to the 19th century, that was part of the Ottoman Empire, which had followed the Byzantine Empire, and so on. So in the early 20th century, you had a truly multicultural, multi-ethnic Ottoman Empire with Muslims living in what is today Greece and with Christians living in what is today Turkey. In 1922, Greece started an expansion campaign towards Turkey that proved disastrous. As part of the settlement and the peace process was that both countries had to sign the Treaty of Lausanne, 1923, that forced all Muslims living in Greece to move to Turkey and all Christians living in Turkey to move, quote-unquote, back home to Greece. It would be like asking, let's say, Italian-Americans here
to go back home to Italy.
Just because of their religious affiliation.
Probably never having seen it.
Exactly, never having seen it, having had roots in that country. And so for that reason, it so happened that both sides of my family immigrated from what is today Turkey to Greece, as I say, back in 1920-23. For Greece, that meant the population increased by a quarter. It was a big impact. And I grew up in Thessaloniki, which was mostly inhabited by immigrants from Turkey. And it hit me at some point that when I was growing up, neither did I nor any of the friends I had knew what our grandmother's courtyard was like, what our grandmother's house was like, because we all had grandmothers who came from Asia Minor. And then I realized that we're all living in someone else's city of memory, because Thessaloniki was also had a very vibrant Muslim community who were expelled to Turkey, and more recently had a very strong Jewish community.
38% of the population.
60,000 people who perished in the Second World War. So it was actually in this country, in the States, that I came to realize that what I call home is also home to other people who have lost it. So I'm trying to do a comparative study of the memory of home, as what I hope will be my third book, both from the Muslim memories of cities like Salonika that or Thessaloniki that is no longer there, so to speak.
They can visit. They're in Turkey now.
Right. They can visit, but they cannot reclaim it. And then cities like Izmir or Smyrna in Turkey, which was which had a strong Greek community, which is where my paternal family came from, that to me has these echoes of familiarity, but not a physical knowledge.
We're talking about architecture and memory with Dr. Elena Bastea. She is Associate Professor of Architecture at the University of New Mexico. Yes, we've talked about your book, Memory and Architecture, and also I was quite fascinated by the book you wrote, which was the outgrowth of your dissertation, your doctoral dissertation, The Creation of Modern Athens. And that was fascinating to me, to talk about what Athens was in the 19th century and the big change that occurred. And unless someone has studied the history of Greece, which I have not, I was amazed to find out that, first of all, Greece had been under the control of first the Byzantine, then the Ottoman Empire. And there was a liberation movement. And in 1833, when basically the Greeks won that battle, Athens was a provincial town with somewhere between 10,000 to 13,000 people.
Very small buildings, very unimportant in terms of the Ottoman administration before that, and became the capital of a kingdom with a new king who came from Bavaria.
That was amazing to me.
17 years old.
Yes, and the next king came from Denmark.
Right. And what attracted me to that was, first of all, I didn't want to do my dissertation in my first book on my hometown because I wanted to have an opportunity to live in Athens. So I took up Athens as the topic. Also because the centralized educational system in Greece, and I would say most other countries, really targets all the information on what happens in the capital. So as you're growing up, no matter what part of Greece you are, you're really learning the history of the nation's capital. So I wanted to have a first-hand experience with how that city developed in the 19th century. It was designed primarily by foreign-trained architects,
The modern city that we know today.
The city that started after 1833, as you said. But my own curiosity was to see what did the local people say about the new designs that were being implemented in their city. And so I spent a lot of time studying the newspapers of the 19th century and looking at the critique that was going on about the built environment. That was one area that really kept my interest both throughout the dissertation and then the several years later of extensive research that I did. But I was also interested in seeing architecture as a way of making the new government manifest to the people. When you have a community that was fairly decentralized and took care of its own administration, as it happened so under the Ottomans.
Almost like the city-states. Almost like the city-states of ancient Greece.
Exactly, which was the Ottoman system. It was quite a decentralized system. And then you move to a Western-style government with ministries, with the parliament, once they voted to have a parliamentary system, with the Ministry of Education, with a palace, and so on. I thought it was really telling that by building these new structures in this small new capital, the new court was communicating to the people what this government was about. They were making this Western style government physically visible to the people.
Yes.
And I think it helped people get used to this shift, radical shift in government.
It was a radical shift.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, you know, it was fascinating because when you talked earlier in the program about the ideal, from what I learned in your book, The Creation of Modern Athens, the style of architecture was influenced by their ideal of what the great classical Athens was.
Exactly. And what you find in the press at the time was, I would say, 3/4 of the comments were in agreement with those ideals. Of course, it has to be neoclassical because it's inspired by the Acropolis. It's our own architecture, so to speak.
Those great columns and big buildings.
Exactly. But at the same time, the general public was also interested in making the city work in terms of garbage removal, in terms of water, in terms of cleanliness, and so on. That's not very fancy.
It's prosaic, but it's basic to the life of the city.
Exactly.
It makes the city livable.
Exactly. So I think in part my own training in Berkeley in architecture that has a tradition of being concerned with people's relationship to the environment was reflected in my research there.
So they had various things that they wanted to do. As you said, they wanted to connect to their classical past when they were rebuilding Athens. They wanted internal political unity and to show we had a centralized government. They were looking to Europe, the modern Europe. Did they succeed in Athens?
The last chapter in that book, The Creation of Modern Athens, which I wrote in 2000 and came out with Cambridge University Press, is concentrated on the first Olympic Games that took place in Athens. And my own evaluation is that the Olympic Games of 1896 actually reflect the success because Europeans came and they were very impressed with New Athens. And finally, the citizens there, by that time, there were over 100,000. They felt that, yes, we can act in this modern environment. We know how to buy a ticket and go to the stadium and find our seat there. We know how to move in this modern city, but we haven't left our traditions behind either. So I'm talking about a certain dualism or bilingualism, where the traditional understanding of space was still present. But on top of it, we have this rather Cartesian way of understanding the city, a city that now has...
Cartesian way?
Cartesian
way. What does that mean?
By that, I mean a city that now has street names, street numbers, and one can give you directions by the following a map.
Right.
As opposed to saying, or in addition to saying, it's next to the... fruit cellar or whatever.
And probably in old Athens in 1833.
They would only have said it's next to the
fruit cellar.
To the fruit cellar,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I don't want to dwell too long on Athens, but what was also fascinating to me reading your book was that the description of what the Parthenon had become about that time, and there was, I think, military barracks in the Parthenon.
Towards the end of the Ottoman period, it was where that Ottoman garrison was stationed, and they had little houses actually all around the Acropolis, and all of that was cleared by German archaeologists and foreign trained archaeologists in the 19th century when they tried to recapture what the Acropolis Hill must have looked like at the time of Pericles. So
it was a priority for them.
It was a priority, and that's how archaeology saw the past. Today, preservationists might want to reclaim the different stages and the sense of continuity in a city's history. But in the 19th century, they wanted to connect the ancient past with the modern period.
Yes. Getting back to your book, Memory and Architecture, one of the interesting chapters in the book is by V.B. Price, who many of our listeners will know. He's a longtime columnist for the Albuquerque Tribune. And he talks about, in his chapter, about profaning sacred space, Los Angeles and New Mexico.
Well, I am very happy to have V.B. Price Barrett in the book because he's so well known here, not only for his architectural criticism, but also for his poetry and other journalism. But I was trying to use him as a test case of my theory that the place that you grow up in is sort of your default place, so to speak, that you use it as
the standard, yes.
Exactly, for measuring other places. So I wanted to question his critique of Los Angeles. I think his essay is quite interesting because he alerts us to what could happen, what has been happening, and what could still happen in New Mexico if we allow this unchecked development to happen, to continue happening, really.
But he talked about the Pueblo and Hispanic builders in New Mexico. He said they had respect for light and our natural resources. Mm-hmm. He came here in the 1940s. He was so charmed by what he called the eccentric architectural gems in downtown Albuquerque. Mm-hmm. And now he's worried about malls and big malls and strip malls and asphalt highways. And he's very concerned about losing the charm of this city.
And that's why I think it is. Sometimes when we use the term memory, I think people might associate it with motherhood and apple pie. Oh, everything about memory is so nice. And I believe that a lot of essays here, V.B. Price is being one of them, that question this. Just because we grew up in a certain environment doesn't mean that's the best way that we should be perpetuating it.
Well, I noticed you never went back to L.A.
Yes, exactly. We should always be alert and question, not get so comfortable with the memories. And frankly, a lot of people leave even their traditional countries because tradition can get very heavy because they question the elders and so on.
But it's a two-edged sword because if you rebuild too much, you can also destroy what history you had and destroy your connection to that place, right?
And I think that's an issue that we deal with in planning and architecture when the new community or the new generation has to build in order to address its own needs. And what that means about the memories of older residents can vary. Sometimes it means destroying spaces that were very special to the previous residents, previous generations. But we also need to feel a degree of freedom to shape the environment, to reflect who we are today. I think coming from Greece, sometimes the burden of the past is so much that you feel you will never have a new building that's worth of international attention because how can you ever surpass the Parthenon? And building in other countries with a great past and an okay present can have the same...
That can be a burden also.
Exactly. It can tie your hands. And
you don't want that either. You want to be able to move forward.
Right. And I also would like to point out, and I think it comes through many of the essays in the book Memory and Architecture, that there is never a unified reading of the built environment. That is, when you come, let's say, to Thessaloniki, you will see different messages. You will get different messages from what even I will get, having lived abroad for a while, or someone being 11 years old will get.
Because I'll see things differently from you.
Yeah, exactly. And even longtime residents will be have different narratives to describe the built environment. So as a historian, I'm interested in recording also these conflicts that arise where I might be very, very attached to a certain corner But for a friend, let's say, whose family used to live in Thessaloniki and is now in Istanbul, that corner will have a different meaning. And I want to work with writing and visual material in a way that reflects these multiple readings, kind of like the Alexandrian Quartet novel, set of novels, for instance, that Lawrence Durrell had written, where you take the same environment and you shine light from different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're very interested in historical narrative. And in Memory and Architecture, you have a chapter that you wrote on storied cities, Thessaloniki and Istanbul. So you're very interested in this historical narrative and from various perspectives. But that, how does that help us understand architecture? How does that relate to architecture?
Well, that particular chapter, actually, what I tried to do was take the history of architecture that I know of these two cities and summarize it, but also take contemporary literature about these cities and then ask myself, if we just pick up a novel on Istanbul today, will we see in that novel the references to the past, the previous groups of people who lived there who are not there anymore? And it was interesting to realize that oftentimes we willingly forget the past, and to realize that buildings by themselves don't talk to us about the past. If I walk down a street and I look at old buildings, I don't necessarily know if there used to be Muslim people living there, Jewish people living there, Christian people living there, Albanians, and so on and so forth. So there is also this significance of the present moment that I think influences us as we walk down a
city. So the
city.
Building in itself does not necessarily have intrinsic significance, but it depends on what we remember or know or have studied about it. That's
yeah,
what you're saying.
Actually, I think a sentence I have there, I don't remember it exactly by heart, but I concluded that chapter by saying buildings don't reveal their personal histories to us any more than families reveal their personal histories to strangers. And it took me a long time to come to that, because I always assumed, well, I'm studying architectural history because buildings reveal their histories. And I cannot really support that by data. Buildings reveal their histories if you want to study that history. Otherwise, they are vessels for the next inhabitant to enjoy and to have good memories, sad memories, and in-between memories.
On that note, I want to thank you, Eleni Bastea, Associate Professor of Architecture at the University of New Mexico, for being with us today. It's been delightful.
I would like to thank you, Jane, and Dick also, and our staff here for arranging this recording.
Tapes of this and other University Showcase programs are available. Just call KUNM at 277-4516. 277-4516. The executive producer of University Showcase is Dick Fredrickson. Our recording engineers today are Kyle Johnson and Evan Molson. I'm your host, Jane Bloom. Thank you for tuning in to University Showcase.